Welcome to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis.
And I'm Tracy Ross, and we're joined by a very special guest, Igor Volsky of Think Progress.
A very special guest. Igor, tell us who you are.
Well, thank you. It's good to be here. I am the director of video at Think Progress, where we make videos about the news in a very visual way.
Well, so say more about that. What kind of videos have you done recently?
So recently, we took to the National Mall to ask Americans if they knew how bad income inequality has really become in this country. We spent 3 days talking to tourists, and most of them, in fact, close to all of them, were shocked to learn of our growing income disparity.
So Americans didn't do very well, is what you're
saying. They mostly failed.
A failing grade for American tourists in D.C.
So yes. What exactly did you ask them?
So we asked them, for instance, since the economic recovery, since the recession, how much of the economic gains that we've seen in this country, how much went just to the top 1% of Americans?
And let's hear a clip of how some of these folks did.
Like 60, 70%?
Definitely around, I would say like 40, 45, 50. I would guess pretty high.
I don't know an exact percentage, but I know it's very high.
It's 95%.
Wow, okay. I thought I was being generous with that.
Wow, definitely, yeah. That's surprising.
And actually, one of the interesting things about the answers is that people are, it seems, at least well aware that income inequality is a problem. It's just that we don't realize how overwhelming a problem.
Yeah, they've heard the conversation. They certainly know that the richest Americans make a lot of money. And when I told them that it was 95%, more than 90% of all of our gains, just to the top 1%, I mean, there was shock. There was laughter. In fact, the reaction was very, in a way, happy, which struck us as very strange.
But what do you mean by happy?
Well, people would kind of just like, you know, kind of laugh at it.
Like it's because it's ridiculous.
Because it's so ridiculous. Huh. Because it's in many cases they're like, ah, yes. You know, in some ways they felt the economic problems. They felt the stagnant wages. They felt you know, the fact that for them, for most of them, they don't have the mobility that maybe their parents had or their grandparents had. So in a way, it's just like, it's so bad, it's kind of funny.
So it's not even like they were shocked. In a way, hearing the real number, they believed it. It sounded completely believable. They just weren't able to come up with that number on their own?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think in some respects, they were surprised, but they also believed it because given the conditions, I think it just felt believable and felt real.
So what other questions did you ask them when you went out to the National Mall?
So we also then asked them what they think the pay disparity is between an average CEO in a top company and the average American worker. And I would prime them. I would say, you know, do you think it's like the average CEO makes 10 times more or 20 times more or 30 times more? And you'll hear the guesses.
All right. So let's hear what some of the folks had to guess.
Say at least 10 times more, probably more than that.
Probably 30 times more?
373 times more.
Wow.
That's unfortunate.
That is crazy, actually.
Shocking, for sure.
That's really shocking. That really is shocking.
Do you know what it was in 1980?
No.
It was 42 times more.
Wow. Yeah, there's something wrong with that picture.
That's a little too ridiculous.
Obviously, the CEOs are getting smarter then.
I don't think it's going to change, never. Unless there are no people on this planet, I don't think they're ever going to change. It's always going to be like that.
So there's a little less laughter in those answers because...
Good point. Good point.
It's a lot more shocking when you're talking about specific people rather than this elusive 1%.
Yeah, those specific people. We also didn't put this in the video, but we also asked what they thought the top CEO in 2014 was. This guy who's head of the Discovery Network, which has the Discovery Channel, TLC. He's the top paid CEO in 2014. Well, let me ask you guys, how much do you think he made in 2014, how much did he take home in 2014 total?
What kind of income are we counting? Are we counting all types of income?
We're counting all
bonuses,
types of income. Bonuses, everything
capital
together.
Capital gains, everything else.
Yeah.
I'm thinking a billion.
I was thinking maybe 2 billion.
See, everybody said a billion. It's actually only $156 million.
We overshot the mark a little bit there, Tracy.
I mean, a billion would be a tremendous amount of money.
And I went with $2 billion.
But I guess all that means is that the people in his company aren't making very much.
In Discovery, actually, you know, the average pay in Discovery, I think we calculated to be somewhere in the neighborhood of $70,000.
Okay.
It's mostly TV producers, and so they kind of get paid more than the average worker, which is about $36,000 a year. But even that disparity between $156,000 and $70,000 mean the average CEO makes that guy makes something like 1,000 times more than the typical worker in his own mm-hmm. company. It's something like 6,000 times more when you compare it to the average American worker.
And it's interesting that you brought that example up, because I was listening to a program this morning, and they were saying that CEOs that work in media companies actually make more than any other CEOs. What do you think the implications are that on our media as a member of the media?
Well, certainly your situation in life informs how you look at the news, how you report the news, what you think is important. And if the person at the top is of a certain income bracket and has a certain set of experiences that don't resemble the overwhelming majority of the country, I think it at the very least informs the direction of the coverage or the priorities of that coverage.
Well, and it's interesting you should say that. We actually later in this episode are going to be having on Sarah Alvarez. She's a public radio reporter from Michigan who was frustrated with really the target audience of public radio and noticed that it was all targeted towards sort of an upper middle class, well-to-do, and by and large white and female, interestingly enough, audience. So we're going to talk with her a little bit about her her decision to launch a news service for low-income news consumers.
And so you put us in the hot seat already, so I think we're going to throw it back to you. Something
Ooh,
that we
yes,
do
yes.
every
right.
week is we have a number of the week that usually relates to one of the segments that we'll have later on in the show. So Rebecca, what's this week's number of the week?
And not to tease our listeners, this time it doesn't relate to a segment we have later in the show, but we thought it was important enough to bring
somewhat on my reporting back home in Oakland.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
so well, fair enough.
I'll make the connection.
Okay.
We'll throw it out there. We'll see what happens.
Okay. Tracy will stretch for us. So, Igor, the number of the week this week is $28.04. What do you think that could represent?
$28.04. Huh. Maybe it represents, I know that America's savings rate is very low. The amount of money people save and put away, far lower than it was decades ago. So I'm going to say that maybe it represents how much money over some period of time Americans are saving on average.
Well, that's an interesting guess. It's wrong.
Well, you are very wrong on the CEO pay, I'll remind you.
You know what? All right. I think arguably I was more wrong on the CEO pay than you are on this one. You were in the right neighborhood. All right. Should we tell him or should we make him guess again?
I think we should tell him.
I think he gets a second guess.
Okay. Ooh, all right.
You get a second guess.
Well, do I get a clue now? Do I have a lifeline?
That's reasonable. Okay. Your clue is it has to deal with the housing market.
The housing market.
It's too good a clue, Tracy.
Is it? I don't think he's going to get it.
Well, tell me the number again. 28.
$28.04.
And $0.04.
And you've had a way too good clue. So if you don't get it this time, I don't know if you'll be invited back.
It's embarrassment washing over me. Well, okay. So if it has to do with the housing market, the housing market is what's slowly recovering, still in trouble.
See, he's going the wrong direction.
I'm going in the wrong direction. Okay, you just tell me. You go ahead.
Put him out of his misery.
We've had embarrassment washed over him. We'll save you. We'll throw you a raft here.
Thank you.
$28.04 is what you have to earn in order to be able to afford a 2-bedroom apartment in Washington, D.C., reflecting really how what an affordability crisis we have when it comes to rental housing in this country.
An hour, $28
an hour. $28.04
an hour
is what you have to be able to earn.
And this relates to a later segment, as I said, because I went to Oakland last week and spoke with some folks at Urban Habitat about gentrification in the Bay Area. I spoke to Bob Allen and Tony Samara, their staffers there, who've been doing a lot of research on gentrification, and it's getting out of control in the Bay Area. So
and I think, apparently in D.C. too.
Right. So this is especially, you know, in our bigger cities, New York also, of course. So this is a huge problem. So they're going to talk about a little bit about affordable housing and some of the things that we can do to try and ensure that people can, you know, live in the cities they want to work and be in.
Well, you know, D.C. has the highest income inequality gap of anywhere in the country. The top 20% makes 7.5 times more than the bottom 20% here in the district.
So we've got a certain crop of people here who have no problem affording housing, and then we have a huge swath who has no real ability, and in fact housing is out of reach, as a national low-income housing coalition report, which is the source of that $28.04 statistic, recently was titled. I mean, you know, and it comes back also, I think, more broadly to, it's obviously not just D.C., it's not just Oakland, it really is a national problem. If you take a look at rents across the country, nowhere, in no city in the United States can you, if you are a full-time minimum wage worker, afford a two-bedroom apartment, in no city, right? So if you're working hard, trying to make ends meet, housing is really out of reach.
Absolutely. And another kind of shocking statistic is that, you know, out of all the people who qualify for some sort of housing assistance from the federal government, only 1 in 4 people actually receives it. So you're going to, you know, hear a lot of conservatives talk about HUD and their involvement in the housing market, and it's really the people who need help aren't getting it.
So Igor, where can our listeners watch the whole video and maybe even find more videos that you've made for Think Progress?
Well, they can go to our website, thinkprogress.org, or facebook.com/thinkprogressvideo.
And this particular video, does it have a title?
Yes. We've played around with different titles. I'm trying to remember what we landed on. I think it's called What Americans Know About Income Inequality, I believe.
That sounds
some
right.
Some
yeah.
version
something
of that.
Something like that.
Yeah.
About right.
Okay. And the answer is not much.
Nothing at all.
Well, and including us.
Right.
2 billion only.
We're like, those 1%ers. Clearly we need to do a little more research on the specific wages, but we got the gist of everything here.
All right. Well, Igor Volsky, thank you so much for joining Talk Poverty Radio.
Thank you for having me.
We'll have to have you back soon.
Even though you got the number of the week wrong.
You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio. I'm Tracy Ross. Last week, I took a trip to my hometown of Oakland, California, which is going through many transformations. To learn more about the gentrification that is occurring there and perpetuating inequality, I reached out to the folks at Urban Habitat, one of my favorite organizations, and equipped with nothing but my iPhone, we were able to talk a bit about what's happening around the Bay. I'm here with Bob Allen, Director of Policy and Advocacy Campaigns, and Tony Roshan Samara, Program Director of Land Use and Housing, both at the Urban Habitat. First, can you tell me a little bit about what Urban Habitat does?
Sure. We're a regional environmental justice organization. We define that broadly at looking at a range of issues from land use, transportation, justice, and housing rights. So kind of a broad, more expansive view of the traditional environmental justice framework. We do a lot of work that's nested around a kind of regional analysis, race and class and regionalism, looking at both how they play out in place-based local communities, neighborhood fights, but also in terms of regional institutions that shape access to opportunity, racialized poverty, class distinctions in metropolitan areas.
Great. And one of the reasons that I was interested in talking to both of you is I've mentioned a few times on our show, I'm originally from Oakland, and I feel like every few weeks I see in the news some sort of story about gentrification in the Bay Area. And gentrification has really become sort of a buzzword. So could you, I guess, help us unpack what that term actually means?
So, you know, gentrification is a term that developed in urban sociology, goes back decades. And so, like a lot of terms that have that kind of history. There's no consensus. But I think it's fairly uncontroversial to say that when we talk about gentrification, we're talking about a change in the class character of neighborhoods. That's the original kind of framework. So when neighborhoods turn from working class low income to middle and upper income, that transformation is generally what we mean by gentrification. That, of course, then implies that there's some kind of displacement that's happening, that people are being pushed out. In the United States, certainly, that term has also been overlaid with a race analysis, in the sense that places where gentrification tends to happen tend to be where low-income people of color have been living.
And we've chatted previously about how the Bay Area is a complicated case study. There are many things other communities can learn from it, but it's also very unique. Can you tell us about the changes occurring in the area?
I think one dynamic that's different than the Bay Area is because we have a fairly aggressive, but compared to the rest of the United States, a forward-thinking policy framework for dealing with the climate change crisis. And all these really broad policy frameworks that, again, on the surface, seem to be pointing us into something we need to do, which is tackle the climate crisis. But what they're also doing under the kind of rubric of smart growth is fueling the cycle of displacement and gentrification that Tony just talked about, and creating a whole set of intended and sometimes unintended consequences, depending upon your perspective, and essentially at a bigger picture level, unpacking and restructuring the patterns of white flight that happened in post-World War II urban development, suburban development. So again, you have this framework where public policy and public funding is supporting a kind of rediscovery of cities as great places to live. And in the planning world, sometimes it's taken on as kind of a lifestyle thing. Like, it's really great to live in a walkable, bikeable, pedestrian-friendly community. And it ranges from that to a real strong push by the real estate lobby and real estate interests to fuel this kind of rediscovery of urban areas and cities. So that kind of hits a nexus with the climate change policy in California and the Bay Area, again, where we're trying to more aggressively to deal with the climate crisis. But the effects of these policies are fueling the displacement and gentrification at the local level. And they're not taking into account the kind of historical forces of race and class that have, you know, developed, especially in the post-World War II development of urban and suburban kind of inequality and
I think if we talk about something that's a bit atypical but certainly very important is the enormous amount of investment capital that's poured into here over the last decade, you know, since the last tech boom. And it's not something that's, you know, that's a surprise to anyone in terms of the impact, but most of the focus tends to be on what it means for the technology sector specifically. But parallel to that, and this is when we start talking about rents and housing prices, is enormous investment in real estate. And the Bay Area, like every metro region, is a part of a global real estate market. And so we're not just talking about investment from other parts of the country, but all over the world. And so we can't just focus on the infusion of capital into the technology sector. That's obviously a huge part of the story. But the parallel is the huge investment that's coming into real estate. And that's, of course, what's more directly driving the increases in housing prices and displacement pressures, gentrification pressures.
So how can we develop in ways ensuring that it's viable for developers to take a risk on a community while helping people who are already here?
I think we have to actually step back and ask what we mean by development. Yeah. Development is actually not that difficult to define, but what happens here and elsewhere is that we assume that any investment is development. And in fact, if investment comes in and displaces people, I would say it's in fact not development. It's a reconcentration of resources for particular populations that have lots of disposable income. If we want to talk about real development, we're talking about, does it improve the education of the people that are there? Does it improve their access to health? Does it improve their access to good jobs? Does it improve their access to amenities like grocery stores? Those are clear indicators that we can say if these things are happening, it's development. By that measure, most of what's happening in the Bay Area and elsewhere in other metro regions is not development. So let's talk about what development really means for communities that we say we care about when investment comes in, and then we wring our hands when we say, why are they complaining? Isn't this what they wanted? Well, no, investment in luxury housing, which produces a few percent of affordable housing, and most people who are there have to leave, that's not development, it's something else.
Also, I mean, I think we have to put out the challenge that we hear that it's possible to do this kind of investment and development in communities without displacing them. We don't have a lot of great examples in the Bay Area or nationally. So I think it is a real political, moral, and intellectual challenge to really show what equitable development looks like. And, you know, we're all trying to think about that. Does it mean jumping ahead of markets before they come too hot? But that consigns a vast swath of the Bay Area population and folks of color around the country to say, sorry, we're too late. You've already been, the wave has already crashed over your community. So I think that's one challenge. I want to go back to the one thing you said earlier, and that I think we really need to contest and to say, the same way we contest the climate change skeptics, displacement is happening. Now, it's true that we need to get better in terms of the research, in terms of quantifying. We know where a lot of people are going, for example, in the Bay Area. We don't have the ability, and for a lot of very good reasons, like privacy and other reasons, we're not going to track people. We also have political problems, which is in the Bay Area, the government agency responsible for looking at housing in the region doesn't count you as displaced if you stay within the 9-county Bay Area as defined by the metropolitan region. So if you're in Eastside San Jose and you're Latino and you have to leave and you end up in Contra Costa County in East County, you're not considered displaced as far as we measure. So the way we measure the problem has to change the analytical tools we bring to bear to kind of track this need to develop. But there should be no question, and we've seen this pop up in some publications about the question, is gentrification really happening? Is displacement really happening? There should be a strong pushback, in my opinion, politically, that this is happening. It's a crisis. It's something that's not a debate. The debate is, what are we going to do to address it?
And so one of the things that you guys look at is, quote, housing justice, which I actually think is a really interesting framework, because a lot of people kind of just put housing as something that they work on, but you guys specifically put housing justice. Can you talk about some of the work that you all are doing to address some of these issues?
Yeah, I mean, the phrase itself is meant to indicate that what it means to improve housing for different people and different populations is not always the same. So in some cases, it could be fighting foreclosures, people who are being kicked out of homes that they nominally own. In other cases, it means rent control and just cause protections for renters. So what housing rights or housing justice means for different populations will be different. And so housing justice is meant to capture the entire spectrum of what it means to improve people's access to safe, affordable, and decent housing. Here, in terms of the work that we do and in terms of what we see the problem essentially being or largely being, is around protection for renters. In many of the cities around the Bay Area, renters are near, or sometimes in Oakland and San Francisco, most of the population are renters. In other jurisdictions, they may not be a majority, but they're a large minority and in many cases a growing minority. And when we look at housing instability, we look at people who are in danger of losing housing, we're primarily talking about renters. And so we're talking about, how do we protect people in their homes today? And that means protections for renters.
I think it's also looking at the phrase affordable housing. And there is a very powerful and important movement for affordable housing in this country. And it distinguishes itself rightly because of some of the political baggage as opposed to, say, public housing. But, you know, we find a lot of our work, because we're not affordable housing developers. The folks in that movement tend to be more on the developing side, and that's an important piece. Production is part of the problem, but as I think Tony laid out, the first part of the problem is community stabilization, protection, keeping people in place. There's a big battle going on, both ideologically and practically, in terms of practical politics, about this notion that we can build our way out of a crisis, which we cannot do if we don't first stabilize communities. But I think there's also a sense that when we do workshops with grassroots allies, like I said, like Just Cause and other groups, we find that the very notion of affordable housing, and we did one of these recently, when you actually break down in a community what the public policy framework for affordable housing looks like, mm-hmm. and then you go through and actually look like that's the affordable housing definition, you'll hear things like area median income, AMI, 120%. When actually you sit with a family, like we did last Friday night at a mm-hmm. church in San Mateo, and go through and actually look at what affordable housing, if they could get it, would do for them on top of their budget and all the other impacts of the recent Wall Street-led crash, even if we could get the affordable housing built, it's not truly affordable. And Tony and the Right to City folks have done work in thinking about what affordable really means and unpacking that term. And I think that's another important thing. It's not a critique of the drive to build affordable housing, but it's a critique of what truly affordable means.
And that leads to kind of another question that I was thinking of is, this is something where profit-driven entities are part of this, you know, universe of players that are involved. But we also see that only 1 in 4 people who qualify for housing benefits from the government actually receive them. So it's going to constantly be this effort where we're going to have to work with private sector leaders as well as government leaders to provide more affordable housing. Do you think that private sector actors will be able to participate in a housing justice framework?
I mean, we were at a meeting yesterday where folks were talking about Section 8 discrimination and the fact that people get vouchers, and under the framework that Tony alluded to earlier about people being given, quote-unquote, access to opportunity in different communities, even if you accept that premise, which a lot of us would contest, that whole framework, what we're finding is insurance companies going to property developers and say, we're not going to provide you insurance if you take on Section 8 folks, or pushing out all their Section 8 folks. There are community legal organizations down in the San Francisco Peninsula that are fighting cases where they're emptying out the Section 8 folks in the same way they empty out Latino and African-American, you know, populations and developments, so that often corporate landlords can come in and flip those properties and turn them around and sell them to a more market rate of tenants. So I think it's a huge challenge. Even when we have these resources, there's still going to be collusion amongst private sector actors to both maximize their possible return, and that includes violating people's, you know, civil rights on fair housing, to kind of less direct ways of or more indirect ways, I should say, of displacing them.
And I think when we look at when we focus on the market, we lose the civil rights lens on the housing question. And as I said, when we look at the patterns, and people have talked about suburbanization of poverty, and of course that is also racialized. And we talk about gentrification, it's racialized. We talk about suburbanization of poverty, it's racialized. And what we see here, and this is one of the ways in which the Bay Area is not atypical, but is part of a broader national pattern in metropolitan regional reconfiguration of populations, we are in fact seeing a resegregation of the city and of the metro region. A kind of, in some ways, not entirely, but a reversal of what we saw in the post-World War II urban renewal era, with concentration of low-income people of color in the urban core and the flight of more affluent whites into the suburban edges. To some extent, a reversal of that. And so for all the talk of diversity and, you know, the kind of urban revival, what we're really seeing, I think, is one stage in a much broader multi-decade resegregation of the city.
And just one final question I have is that obviously there's a lot of important policy implications of the sorts of issues we've been talking about. But one thing that I've been struck by in particular about conversations about gentrification is some of the more cultural aspects, the cultural change. It can stir up a lot of strong emotions. I think we saw this. There was that viral video of the Dropbox employees and the Mission trying to take the soccer field from some of the local kids. And then there's this quote from one of my favorite writers, Ta-Nehisi Coates, who says, "Black people have not owned much in this country. And yet in the later years of the 20th century, we felt we owned many of America's great cities. We didn't. I suspect much of our present angst can be traced to the lifting of that illusion." Mm-hmm. So given these sorts of things, how do you think community leaders can address the disempowering effects of gentrification?
Well, I think we're seeing good examples of that here. There are lots of community-based organizations working on that very question, and that's also true in other metro regions. I mean, in terms of preserving, you know, I think the issue is not always so much of preserving a particular culture, because you look at any community from the famous Harlem Renaissance to others, those were not static communities. They were dynamic. They were changing all of the time. But at some level, because to some extent they had been abandoned to people of color, they were able to develop on their own terms within the context of much broader structural constraints, economic and so on. So I'm certainly not, you know, holding up that era of segregation as a model. However, the reality is because there was a certain inattention, they were able to develop according to their own dynamics. And I think that's what we're talking about much more than anything else, is the loss of, in a sense, a kind of sovereignty within the context of a broader racialized segregation. And now we're seeing the loss of that without any real benefit. It's not as though there's a loss of culture, but it's being made up for by an increase in economic opportunity or access to better housing. They're losing that too. So what has to happen is that concern around the loss of a cultural ownership has to be linked to struggles for economic ownership, for political ownership, right? I mean, we can't separate the cultural from the economic and the political. And the really good organizations, the ones like House Host and others that we've talked about, is that they recognize that and they're organizing within the nexus of those range of categories and building movements that address all of these dimensions of human life.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. And hopefully we can work together again in the future.
Sure. I'd be happy to.
You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio on the We Act Radio Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis.
And I'm Tracy Ross, and we're back with the Weekly Worst. I'm glad to be in on this one.
Isn't it the Weekly-ish Worst at this point?
Weekly-ish. That's accurate.
Alan,
Welcome.
Alan Pike is here.
The week is a social construct.
That, of course, is Alan Pike with Think Progress, who joins us every week with three news stories that are just awful related to poverty, and we get to vote on them, call them out, and you've got some great ones for us,
good
right?
Good lead in, Tracy. That was good. That was good.
Yeah, Alan? First off, we got the Arizona legislature, which just voted to start kicking people off of welfare after just 12 months, which joins Texas as the strictest time limit for TANF anywhere in the country. And the decision is part of an effort to plug the state's budget holes, and it's only possible because of a 1990s federal law that turned welfare into a block grant that states can use however they see fit, which is something that conservatives are eager to do with every other anti-poverty program that they can.
TANF, of course, being temporary assistance for needy families, which is basically all we have left of cash welfare in this country for very, very, very poor families with kids.
And I mentioned that they joined Texas in being the only states that have a 12-month time limit on welfare benefits, but in a sense, they're actually being tougher than Texas. Because in Texas, if you're a kid and your mother or father both get booted off of TANF because of the time limit, you can stay on for 5 years because nobody wants to put kids into the gutter. But Arizona's not going to have that kind of an exception.
And so this
even stricter
further illustrates that a lot of states are concerned with getting people off of the program rather than getting people out of poverty
or into jobs But hey, priorities.
So what's the next story you have for us?
All right. At the annual McDonald's shareholder meeting in Oak Park, Illinois last week, an unidentified shareholder spoke up to warn that paying $15 an hour would deprive the world of its great artists and thinkers. Sharon Stone, Jeff Bezos, and Shania Twain, to name just a few, have all worked at McDonald's years before they became famous and successful. And this shareholder stood up during a Q&A to say, quote, "I'm sure if they were making $15 an hour, they'd still be working at McDonald's."
So this is the Shania Twain argument for keeping McDonald's wages below what one can live on.
Right.
This is amazing. This might be the best weekly worst ever.
Shania Twain, by the way, made something like $58 million last year, which I think that's Canadian dollars. I'm not sure. But still a hell of a lot of money.
So what I'm taking away from this is that poverty wages inspire people to greatness. It helps motivate them to pursue their dreams.
That's a really positive spin there, Tracy.
Well, that's what he's saying. I obviously disagree. I think maybe getting a living wage could help people reach their dreams faster. But...
Well, and if you've been holding McDonald's stock for 25 years, and you can afford to fly out to the Chicago area for the annual meeting and spend several hours of your life that you'll never get back in a Q&A session with the McDonald's CEO, I would imagine that you're part of an income bracket that doesn't necessarily have the greatest familiarity with what life is like for actual, service workers.
I feel like that was the most poetic way of saying this guy is a jackass.
It's almost as poetic as what Alan said before we got in studio, which was, man, I feel like a wage slave.
Wow. I was not seeing that one coming.
There were
so
a lot of puns
to do a duet
that got
with you
cut
there.
From
I'm
that
sorry,
piece.
Alan.
If people go to the site, they'll see a lot of holes where puns ought to be.
I couldn't take credit for that one. To all of our listeners, take this to show that I am an honest broker.
I also like, whose bread have your meats been under? But that's a slightly deeper Shania cut that gets past the top couple of hits.
All right, I think it's time for you to tell us the third story.
Story number three. Real estate developers have been hard at work in America's cities in the past few years, but unless you're very wealthy, you haven't seen any benefit from that work. And that's because 4 out of every 5 newly built apartments from 2012 to 2014 was a luxury home, a luxury living space. And that's according to real estate market research that was published in the Wall Street Journal recently. The problem is that federal money for affordable housing is starting to dry up. It's fallen victim to the budget acts here in Washington as Congress and the White House have gotten obsessed with deficits. So private developers are simply going where the money is, and that's not where our societal need is. They're mismatched. So you get, I think it's 82% of all the apartment units that were finished in new buildings in something like 54 separate cities in the last 3 years were targeted to the very top end of the income bracket.
I feel like this one fits in pretty well with our number of the week. I mean, so I don't know if you were around to hear that one, Alan, but you have to earn more than $24 an hour to be able to afford a 2-bedroom apartment in D.C., reflecting what an affordable housing crisis we have. So
that sounds like a lot.
It is. And
it is a lot.
like, you picked up on that one, Alan.
He's getting smarter with every episode.
But also, you know, we have an interview with the folks at Urban Habitat this week when out in Oakland to talk to them about gentrification and what's going on in the Bay Area and really around the country. And I think they, you know, pointed out that it's great that we have, you know, inclusionary zoning laws in places where a certain percentage of market rate buildings will be affordable. But we can't, you know, I guess, assume that that's going to meet the demand. We have an incredible demand for affordable housing. Housing prices are rising as wages are stagnant. So it really is a crisis, and we can't really rely on the private sector entirely to meet that.
Tracy dropped some knowledge there.
You said you weren't going to talk about dropping knowledge.
Just not for myself. Okay, so those are our three. I'm sorry. I just have to show my hand. How can anyone possibly vote for anything that doesn't involve Shania Twain?
I was going to say, I want to admit that's my vote.
So it's my vote, too.
It's a sweep.
We've never had this before.
I 6-year-old Alan would not forgive 28-year-old Alan if I failed to vote for Shania Twain in this instance. And honestly, it's sort of a fun story to talk about, but I think it's maybe not as intuitive as it might seem to us why this is such a silly thing to say, because it sounds on its face, you know, it sounds almost reasonable that if you make it possible to get by working in a suboptimal field like making fries and slinging burgers, then potentially there's some set of people who will receive that wage who might have otherwise, you know, gone on and followed some dream of theirs out of desperation that won't do so. But if you actually do the math on that sort of that idea that seems totally reasonable in a classroom or in a vacuum, if you do the math, $15 an hour works out to just a little over 30 grand a year before taxes. I'm guessing plenty of folks who listen to this show are themselves parents or have parents. Try to imagine providing for a family on $31,000 a year before taxes. You're not going to be able to do it. Shania Twain is a great example, not of the point that this guy was making in Illinois, but of the opposite point, which is that the people who work these jobs aren't teenagers trying to make extra summer cash. They're people, in many cases, people trying to support families. One out of every five children in America has a parent who would benefit from raising the minimum wage. Shania Twain was orphaned before she was legal drinking age. She was like 20 or 21. And had to look after her three younger siblings. She provided for them by singing at a vacation resort, not by staying at McDonald's. It's hard to believe that she would have done so at any wage when she had three young kids to support financially as a young person herself.
I think Alan summed it up better than either of us can. Tracy, absolutely. You're nodding your head. I think looks like you agree. We got Alan there.
Also, can we just say that it's an insulting argument? I mean, also, how many other people could go on to pursue great things, but they're stuck in a poverty trap because of these low wages? Shania Twain's obviously very talented. There's a lot of talented people who are living in poverty that, you know, this argument is somehow that they'll be pushed into stardom is ridiculous, because we'd have more people doing great things if they could.
Also, just to reiterate the offensiveness before we wrap, I mean, to say that we need to make our entry level jobs as crappy as possible so that people will have no choice but to find a better way to provide for themselves, right? I mean, that's just not only is it crap, right, but also it's really offensive, given that what we need to be doing is investing in pathways to good jobs, right? Yeah. And the same people who oppose raising the minimum wage are the ones who want to defund and would never consider actually investing in subsidized employment, apprenticeships, national service, education, you know, access to Pell Grants and so forth, right? That we need to be constructing ladders of opportunity, not making our lowest rung opportunities as crappy as possible so people will be forced to get out of them.
Absolutely. It's a lot of the same in that way. I think it's got a lot in common with the basic ideology underlying the Arizona welfare time limit thing.
Yeah.
This idea, this very widespread idea that the way to fight poverty is to make poverty suck as much as possible, to rip as many holes as you can, as large as you can in the safety net, so that the people, you know, on a high wire above it will be so afraid of falling onto that net and not being caught that they'll somehow, you know, magically find a better job, magically find an agent who will take them to Nashville or whatever it might be, whatever goals and ambitions they have in their own lives, however humble, that are higher than working at the grill at a burger joint.
Right.
It's very convenient if you're a taxpayer to say, what if we just give everybody less? Then they'll do better. Because that's very self-serving, but it's not realistic.
Absolutely.
Bourdieu meets bootstraps. And on that note,
that is the Weekly Worst. Thanks for joining us, Alan. And we'll have you back next week or the week after. We don't know.
Sometime soon.
In the future.
Awesome. Thank you. I'm going out tonight.
You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio. I'm Rebecca Vallis. We at Talk Poverty Radio recently came across InfoWire, which targets news to low-income news consumers. To learn more about InfoWire, we brought in Sarah Alvarez, who founded it. She's also the senior producer and public insight analyst at Michigan Radio. Sarah Alvarez, thank you so much for joining Talk Poverty Radio.
Thanks for having me.
So Talk Poverty is actually having its one-year anniversary right now.
Congratulations.
And I understand that an initiative that we've brought you on to talk about, InfoWire, is also having or recently had an anniversary.
Yeah, that's true. We're celebrating, I guess, the one-year anniversary of our pilot phase.
So tell us a little bit about InfoWire and the motivations for creating it. What is it and who is it for?
Sure. Well, it's basically a news service for low-income news consumers. And the reason I wanted to start it was because I heard somebody speak named James Hamilton. He's an economist and he's a professor at Stanford. And he was talking about how the work that he's done has shown that mainstream media is not trying to serve the needs of low-income news consumers. So they're targeting their content at the person who can buy all of the things that they're trying to sell their advertising space to. What I mean by that is, like, you know, they're trying to attract advertisers. And so in order to attract those advertisers, they're also trying to attract very attractive consumer for those advertisers. So it means that most mainstream media is being targeted toward middle income and higher income individuals. And I don't think people are doing it necessarily to be exclusive, but that's the effect it's having. So people who are lower income, their communities are not being covered in a way that's informative. They might be covered, but only in a way that would be interesting to somebody who didn't live there.
And in an interview that you gave with The Atlantic talking about InfoWire and why you saw fit to launch this initiative, you described media, mainstream media, as sort of going through an exercise of targeting a hypothetical consumer named Mary. Who is Mary? What are her demographics?
Well, I'm sure that every organization has this. Public radio has Mary, and she is a very well-educated, well-resourced. She's middle class. She's white. She's a woman. And it's just this kind of generic person who you're asking, well, would Mary be interested in this? Or why would Mary care about this? And I don't think people are doing it just to on purpose necessarily target higher income white people, but that's the effect that it has. And I think every news organization has this idea of their target demographic. And the reason that it's our target demographic is because that's the majority of people who listen. So we're targeting our content toward the people who are already listening to us, not to new people who we could serve.
And you point out that she's Mary, she's not Maria.
I was kind of joking, but in my mind, right? So I'm Latina, like in my mind, I want to also target my content toward Maria. You know, like I want to be able to reach people who the mainstream.
So what does media that targets a lower income news consumer look like? What makes it different from the news that might be targeting Mary?
Well, I would hope that it would be very similar in that it would be useful. It would be informative, right? So to make news and content, I think, that matters for low-income news consumers, you have two different types of content, right? You have narrative content, content about, like, great storytelling, right? And so I think there are lots of shows that do this very well and appeal to people across the board. and in public radio, like I'm thinking of like Snap Judgment, I'm thinking of The Moth, I'm thinking of Radiolab. Like those are informative for everybody. They're really interesting. But then there's also the news part. And the news part needs to have information that helps the community that's getting this information hold people accountable. And a lot of the reporting about low-income communities is just that. It's about low-income communities. It's like, oh, look what's happening over here. Look at this school. It's such a mess, you know, and people in that neighborhood know that. People who send their kids to that school know that. But is it going to help them improve upon the strengths that are already there, hold the right people accountable for what's going wrong? If it doesn't do that, then I don't think it's helpful or useful news product.
So sort of the distinction between voyeurism and information heavy news.
Yeah, our program director here, Tamar Charney, she's great. And I don't know where she got this from, but she sent it around to everybody. And she said that one thing that we need to try not to do is to report on people as if they are behind the museum glass, as if we're just like looking at them and saying like, oh, wow, like look how life is over there. You know, we really need to connect people to each other, and we really need to be respectful of whoever it is in our story and who we're trying to serve. So I always keep that in my mind when I'm trying to write these InfoWire stories of, are they informative and are they respectful?
So can you give us a couple of examples of stories that InfoWire has produced?
Sure. I'm working on a series right now about the choices that young people have who want to be successful but are not interested in going to more school, or maybe questioning the value of higher education directly out of high school. So I'm working on that series. So I'm going through different options like, you know, is a GED worth it? Is going into some kind of apprenticeship program or career, you know, vocational education worth it? What about the military? And because I think these stories tend to be told in a way where it's like thrown out there as like, well, that's an option. But we're not really delving into like, what are the pros and cons of all of this? And what are the pros and cons of higher education? And how can you take a good look at all of those things and make a sound decision? I do a lot of reporting on juvenile justice. I do a lot of reporting on foster care. And I'm trying to, and when those are InfoWire pieces, what I'm trying to do is make those pieces helpful and worth it to people who are in the system, who already know the drawbacks and the good things that could happen, and just really helping people navigate those systems that they might be in.
It strikes me that, you know, daily, whether we're listening to public radio or if we're watching television, we'll see stock updates, and we'll see in, you know, in print media as well, we'll read articles that are about personal finance and real estate. And in fact, newspapers have whole sections about investment and personal finance. And what you're describing is sort of the analog of real experiences that people will encounter and need more information about.
Right, right. And I mean, I guess, you know, like, I don't use the stock updates, right? That's not helpful to me.
Me either, in full disclosure.
yeah, you know, that's not. But I'm also not going to crumble up my paper and throw it away if I see that. And I think that a lot of organizations aren't sure if there's a value to kind of trying to provide news to a lower income news consumer. I don't know if they're worried about maybe turning off a higher dollar consumer, but, you know, we all take in a lot of news that we're not necessarily connected to or interested in. So I think there's definitely room in the ecosystem of news for some content that could try to serve a new consumer. And there's a lot more we have to learn about these consumers, because we don't, especially in public media, we don't even know very much about them, about what they're looking for, about where those information gaps are and what they would like to have from a news organization that, you know, is meeting their needs.
Well, and taking that one step further, is there potentially actually a business case for targeting more media towards lower income news consumers?
I think it's all a business case. I mean, I think there is, of course, like a reason to do it outside of that, right? Here's a big group of people that isn't being served. And so here's a big group of people who aren't being held accountable, you know, who are messing up systems. But there, of course, is a business case. I mean, companies have really changed as income inequality becomes something that we are all more familiar with. And as the middle class kind of shrinks, we are seeing corporations target lower income consumers, sometimes in predatory ways, but also in respectful ways. I was just reading something about how Old Navy has totally outpaced The Gap and Banana Republic in that kind of brand sphere because they're giving a fashion forward, low dollar good. And how they got better was they decided to make their stuff look better and really take into account the desires of their target consumer. So we haven't done that yet in news. And I think if we do that, of course, we can bring more people in. But it's hard because the business case in every kind of news is a mess right now, right? So we don't really understand the economics of news, and that's why it's hard to kind of go after a new demographic. But I think there is a reason for it, and I want to learn more about that, that's for sure.
Are there media out there aside from InfoWire that already do this well?
I think ethnic press tends to do a great job with this. I look at the Spanish language press's coverage of immigration in particular as incredibly informative and really accessible. So yes, and then there's like ethnic press, there's local press that sometimes do a great job of really informing people. But the bigger organizations, I think, don't do as good of a job. But you'll see pieces because I'm always looking for it. I will see pieces every now and again where I'm like, this is a great InfoWire piece. It's just not really targeted in that way, but it could be. You know, there's, I think a lot of news organizations are doing things that are close, but not quite there.
So how is InfoWire distributed and where can our listeners find more about it?
Sure. So you can find it if you just like search for InfoWire. It will come up in a Google search. You can also text to receive updates on your phone, and you can email to get an update whenever there's a new piece, and it'll come to your email box. So, and it's something I will say that we really encourage people to take these InfoWire pieces and do whatever they want to them, adapt them, print them out, you know, hack them. It's just information. So the point is for it to be useful to people however they see fit.
And are you encouraging other news media out there then to take your stories and incorporate them and integrate them into what they're doing?
Oh, that would be great. I mean, go for it. The good thing about being public media is you could just say, take it, you know? I really don't even care if I'm attributed at all. Like, just take it, do something with it if it's helpful, or let me know, you know what, this is where I see an information gap. I'm always looking for tips for good stories to cover.
Well, Sarah Alvarez, thank you so much for joining Talk Poverty Radio.
Oh, thank you.
And congratulations and happy anniversary to InfoWire.
You too.
So having just spoken with Sarah Alvarez about InfoWire, we thought it was appropriate to celebrate a very big birthday/anniversary. With that, we've got Greg Kaufman, editor-in-chief of Talk Poverty. Welcome, Greg.
Thanks for having me.
And congratulations on the one-year anniversary of the site. Can you tell us a bit about what TalkPoverty.org is?
TalkPoverty.org is very similar to what we do here at Talk Poverty Radio. I mean, we feature low-income people, writers. We feature writers who are working on poverty in all kinds of days, in all kinds of ways on many days. And, you know, really try to give people a sense of authentic experiences in poverty and what we can do to dramatically reduce poverty. And we also have data and other kinds of tools and resources, suggested readings. But I mean, really, the voices on our blog are really the highlight for us.
And why did you found Talk Poverty? I mean, rumor has it that you, I shouldn't say rumor, we had Katrina Vandenhoevel on last week who told us that you used to be the poverty correspondent at The Nation magazine, but you left to come to CAP to establish Talk Poverty. Why did you do that?
Well, I mean, the reason we established the poverty beat at The Nation was because we really felt like low-income people were missing from the poverty stories when they were written. So that was a real focus of our work. And when I came here, the idea was rather than one reporter trying to cover as much as he could about poverty, why not have people who are living in poverty write about their experiences? We could cover a lot more ground. People working on poverty write about it. And in this year, we can feel really good about it that, you know, we can cover a lot of ground as a community between the people living in poverty and people working on poverty.
You have not only people living in poverty, but you have service providers, people working on the ground on these issues. What kinds of stories have been resonating with your readers?
Well, I have to say, I didn't know this would happen. I don't think any of us knew this would happen. But really, the pieces by our low-income contributors have done the best. And I think that's because there's such an absence of these voices in the media still. And so, for example, a real highlight for me was a couple of weeks ago, Andrea Fuller from Colorado. She works a little with the group Hunger Free Colorado. And she wrote about her experiences both as a child and an adult in poverty. And BillMoyers.com picked it up. They've picked up a lot of our pieces and have really helped us gain a wider readership. Anyway, I went to the site, and their number one most read, number one most shared, number one most discussed was her piece. And
on Bill Moyers.
On Bill Moyers, exactly. And I really think that's because people want to know what's really going on out there, and that there aren't enough media outlets still doing that. I would also say pieces that show an intersection between poverty and, say, criminal justice reform or homelessness and jobs, things that show the intersection of issues do really well on our site.
Instead of just things in topics and silos that maybe are always discussed only in isolation.
Exactly. That's a big part of what we try to do is break down those silos.
So, Tracy, should we sing?
I think so.
Oh.
And I should note, this isn't just the anniversary of Talk Poverty. Greg, you have another anniversary this week.
That's true. 10th anniversary of my wedding.
You looked like you needed help there, remembering what that was.
Well, congratulations.
Hopefully you celebrated adequately.
God bless your wife.
God bless her indeed. You are right
about
that.
Well, we got to sing a little. Happy birthday. Okay, I think that's enough.
Yeah. And with that, faces and voices made for radio, Tracy Ross and Rebecca Vallis signing off.
And that's our show. Thanks for listening to Talk Poverty Radio on the We Act Radio Network. We'll be back next week, Thursday at 4, also available on iTunes as a podcast, or you can listen online at weactradio.com. Special thanks to our executive producers, Alyssa Peterson and the one and only Greg Kaufman.
Special thanks also go out to our great intern, Will Strong.
CAP's amazing poverty and press teams.
And as always, DC's own Chris Stiles Bacon gets the last word. Thanks for listening.
I work and get paid like minimum wage. Sights to hit the clock by the end of the day. Hop from downtown into the hood where I stay. The only place I can't afford cause my block ain't safe. I spend most of my time working trying to bring in the dough. And none of those could connect me with the HMO. And nowadays it's common for grandparents to outlive their grandkids. And those are the type of odds that we handling. I'm not a slave to a man with a whip. I'm a slave to the U.S. men. And it got me doing things in my life that never made any sense. But it paid me in dollars and cents. I need the money for the food, the health care, the schools and bus fare. You can't pay the rent without the U.S. right there. With shackles on my hands and toes, they got a brother moving slow, but my soul is determined to go. I want freedom, freedom. Now I don't know where it's at, but it's calling me back. I feel my spirit is revealing the map. We just trying to get freedom. What we talking about?
Man, I feel like a woman.
You are listening to the We Act Radio Network, produced in Washington, D.C. Visit us online at weactradio.com.